saw. The only good news came the next morning when reports that a new sort of artillery fuse was being used effectively against the German strongpoint in the town of Echternach. "We actually killed 700 of them," he wrote offhandedly in his journal. Now he spends the 26th, Boxing Day, having heard that some of his tanks are within a half dozen miles of Bastogne. But today, as with yesterday and the day before, victory hardly seems likely. Reports filtering back to his headquarters state that his tank divisions continue to take heavy casualties. Making matters worse, far worse, is that rather than helping Patton by pushing his own army south toward Bastogne, British Field Marshal Montgomery refuses to attack. He says his army is not ready, and instead of encouraging Patton's audacious plan to relieve the 101st, Montgomery is deepening their professional rivalry by predicting that Patton and the Third Army will fail. When Montgomery goes so far as to actually insist to Eisenhower that Patton return to Metz, claiming that Patton's army is too small to take Bastogne, Patton severs all pretense of friendship with his British counterpart, calls the idea of retreat to Metz disgusting. But Montgomery's behavior only adds to the pressure on Patton, because a simple look at the current battlefield situation map shows that one thing is becoming even clearer. No one can save the battered bastards of Bastogne except for Patton and his Third Army. In fact, no one else is even making the effort. No one. That same day, the phone in Patton's headquarters rings. Major Hugh Gaffey, commanding the 4th Armored, is on the other end, requesting permission to launch a high-risk attack into Bastogne immediately. Patton does not hesitate. "I told him to try it," he will write in his journal tonight. With that order, the 4th Armored Division begins fighting their way toward Tony McAuliffe and the trapped men of the 101st. Lieutenant Colonel Creighton Abe Abrams commands the spearhead 37th Tank Battalion of the 4th Armored Division. He chews on a long, unlit cigar, so enormous that his men compare it to the barrel of a gun. Abrams is 30 years old, a lantern-jawed Massachusetts native who graduated from West Point just 8 years ago. Someday, he will be chief of staff of the Army, a 4-star general so famous that they will name a type of tank after him. But right now, Abrams is just a bold young tank commander who is making plans to disobey a direct order. Perched atop a hill just a few miles away from Bastogne, Abrams sits tall in the turret hatch of a Sherman tank, nicknamed Thunderbolt 7. He has already had 6 Sherman shot out from under him, all named Thunderbolt. In September, he was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for courage under fire. Abrams' men love him because he is a lax disciplinarian away from the battlefield and knows there is a time and place for fun. But when it comes to fight, they also know they are expected to do precisely as their commanding officer orders. A long line of Shermans snakes down the narrow and rutted country road behind Abrams. These tanks also have names: Cobra King, Deuces Wild, Betty, Destruction, and so on. Lieutenant Colonel Abrams has been tasked with capturing the heavily fortified town of Sabret, which lies 3 miles to the northwest. But his unit is down to just 20 Sherman tanks, and his infantry is short 230 men. Abrams does not like the Sabret scenario, even though that is the plan that his commanding general, George Patton, has just approved. Scanning the horizon with his high-powered binoculars, Abrams watches hundreds of C-47 cargo planes dropping supplies to the besieged men of Bastogne. Parachutes laden with ammo and food blossom against the leaden sky. But at the same time, German anti-aircraft fire is shooting down many of the slow-moving twin-engine supply planes. They spiral to the earth, soon to explode, the pilots consigned to a fiery and instant death. The sight of this humanitarian airdrop, paired with the knowledge that American soldiers have been suffering and dying inside Bastogne for more than a week, fills Abrams with a sense of urgency. Why attack Sabret? The town is heavily defended, and capturing it will not bring Patton's army closer to Bastogne. Why not bypass Sabret and go directly to McAuliffe's aid? Abrams ponders that question as he continues to survey the battlefield. He sees the men of the 101st crouched in their snowy foxholes. He also knows that hundreds of hidden Germans are waiting to destroy any rescuing force. But Lieutenant Colonel Abrams is convinced that he and his men can get through. So Abrams radios a request for permission to launch an all-out blitz on the tiny hamlets of Clochemont and Assenois. This is the most direct route into Bastogne. If he takes those towns, Abrams can be in Bastogne within hours. But if the impromptu plan fails, his small force would surely be wiped out. The narrow road he plans to use could become a death trap. The request goes to Major General Gaffey, who passes it along to Patton. The attack is approved. Abrams soon orders all available American artillery in the area to launch an immediate barrage to soften the German defenses. The thunder of 155-millimeter guns soon booms across the Belgian countryside as shell after shell is lobbed on the German positions hidden within the forests. In all, more than 2,000 rounds will fall on the Wehrmacht fighters today. "Get those men in Bastogne," Abrams commands his tankers. He waves his arms high in the air, and his tanks churn forward. There's nothing quick about their movement. The Sherman's top speed is about 30 miles per hour. Nor is there any way to conceal their advance. Thanks to the artillery barrage, the Germans know the Americans are coming. They can now clearly see Abrams and his line of Shermans and half-track armor steering down the hill into Clochemont. Abrams closes the hatch and conceals himself inside the 3-inch thick steel of the turret as his and the other Shermans burst through the ancient town square. German artillery explodes all around. One shell knocks down a telephone pole, blocking the road and bringing the column of 5 Shermans and a half-track to a lurching halt. The pole has to be moved. Abrams and several other men immediately climb out of their tanks. With sniper fire pinging off steel and glancing off the rutted road, they work as a team to swing the heavy pole out of the way. Then it's back into their Shermans. Behind them, a column of infantry secures the small town and will stay there until the mopping up action is complete. A second column of foot soldiers travels with Abrams' tanks as they move toward the concealed German positions in the forest alongside the road. Rather than simply race through the town, Abrams chooses to level it. Every building that might conceal a German becomes a target. The Shermans load and shoot their big 76-millimeter guns, as many as 7 times per minute. Meantime, the infantry ruthlessly hunts down Germans, screaming, "Come out!" to induce them to surrender. "But they wouldn't," one American soldier later remembers. "One poked his head of a foxhole, and I shot him in the neck." Trouble soon strikes. The jeep carrying the artillery observer is hit before he can give the signal to halt the barrage. The American artillery continues to rain down shells, unaware that Abrams and his men are already inside the town. 360 rounds of artillery shells are fired by the American big guns. Geysers of earth erupt throughout the town as each shell forms its own deep crater. Frantic radio calls from Lieutenant Charles Bogus, who now leads Abrams' spearhead in his tank, Cobra King, go unheard. Americans and Germans both are killed. The American shelling and the nonstop tank barrage are completely decimating Assouan, wiping off the map as if it never existed. Plumes of fiery smoke and dust turn the daytime sky black. Finally, a spotter plane sees the trouble and orders the artillery to stop. The Germans lay tiller anti-tank mines on the road in a last-ditch effort to stop the American breakthrough. None of the Shermans is hit, but an American half-track explodes when it hits a mine, killing the driver and again bringing the American column to a halt. Thinking quickly, Captain William Dwight, Abrams' operations officer, risks his life by climbing out of his tank and exposing himself to fire as he clears the mines out of the road by hand. Through the dust and smoke, Private James Hendricks, the son of an Arkansas sharecropper, spots 2 concealed German 88-millimeter guns. Next to them, hiding in a foxhole, are 2 Wehrmacht soldiers. Hendricks crouches low and moves toward them, through a hedgerow, then presses his body flat in a shell crater as he creeps up to the enemy. Hendricks is just 5'6", weighs only 125 pounds, but he shows no fear as he prepares to attack the German foxhole alone. "A fellow just figures if it's his time, it's his time, and that's all there is to it," so he later explains his courage. Screaming, "Come out!" in German, Hendricks runs up to the foxhole with his M1 aimed squarely at the enemy soldiers. They don't surrender. Hendricks is forced to shoot one soldier in the head and then smash the skull of the other with his rifle butt. "I got their guns and got back in my shell hole and started hollering, 'Come out!' And sure enough, them Germans began coming out from around different foxholes, and 13 gave up." He will later recall describing the action that will earn him the Congressional Medal of Honor. Later that night, in fierce pitch-black fighting that will see few prisoners taken on either side, Hendricks will add to his legacy by personally knocking out 2 German machine gun nests and also braving sniper fire to pull a wounded American from a burning half-track. The battle in the forest will continue long into the night, but by afternoon, the Americans have carved a small channel through the German lines. The path is less than 400 yards wide, and Germans are poised on both sides, prepared to counterattack and once again close the road. But for now, American tanks are advancing toward Bastogne. Bogus fires on a small German pillbox on the outskirts of Bastogne. The smoke clears. First Lieutenant Charles Bogus opens the turret of Cobra King and lifts his torso up through the opening. Soldiers in uniform crouch in foxholes across the road to his right, their guns aimed his way. "Come on out! This is the 4th Armored," he shouts. He does not yell in German, hoping to find an American reply. There is no answer. A tense moment passes. With his head and chest completely exposed to rifle fire, Lieutenant Bogus considers his options. The Sherman 76mm barrel pivots until it's aimed directly at the foxholes. Private James Murphy has already loaded a round, and the gunner, Corporal Milton Dickerman, awaits the order to fire. "Come on out," Bogus nervously shouts again. A lone soldier walks forward. "I'm Lieutenant Webster of the 326 Engineers, 101st Airborne Division," he says. "Glad to see you." Bastogne has officially been relieved. Cobra King rolls into the heart of town, followed by a convoy of Sherman tanks. Soon, Abe Abrams appears. "Gee, I am mighty glad to see you," says General Tony McAuliffe. Patton's audacious gamble has succeeded. He awards Abrams with the equivalent of a 2nd Distinguished Service Cross and praises him as America's top tank commander, even saying that Abrams is a better tank commander than he. The next morning, December 27, 1944, George Patton once again walks to the front of a small Catholic chapel and drops to his knees in prayer. "Sir, this is Patton again," he begins with an air of contrition. "And I beg to report complete progress. Sir, it seems to me that you have been much better informed about the situation than I was, because it was that awful weather which I cursed you so much, which made it possible for the German army to commit suicide. That, sir, was a brilliant military move, and I bow humbly to your supreme genius." The German advance stalled on Christmas Eve 1944. Basically, the Germans overran their supply lines, and without ammunition and gasoline, they were unable to wage an offensive campaign. The continued progress of Patton and his Third Army eventually spelled doom for Operation Watch on the Rhine. By January 25, 1945, the Germans had retreated back to the same positions they had held at the start of the offensive 6 weeks earlier. Thus ended the last great German attack on the Western Front. "The relief of Bastogne is the most brilliant operation we have thus far performed and is, in my opinion, the outstanding achievement of this war," Patton writes home to his wife, Beatrice. "Now the enemy must dance to our tune, not we to his." Chapter 13, White House, Washington, D.C., January 20th, 1945, 11:55 a.m. War is never far from the minds of Americans, even on a unique day in the nation's history. Hope that the Second World War would end by New Year's Day has been abandoned. Wounded soldiers, many on crutches, are among the 7,000 invited guests, tromping through harsh weather to witness Franklin Delano Roosevelt swearing in as President of the United States. This will be the first inaugural address during wartime since Abraham Lincoln spoke 80 years ago in 1865. Also, this is the first inaugural to be held at the White House in the President's backyard, as the South Lawn is known. Finally, this is the first and only time an American president will be sworn in for a 4th term. A light snow dusts the White House on the Saturday afternoon as spectators show their invitations to the security guards, then pass onto the wintry lawn. It stopped snowing 3 hours ago, but the skies are threatening yet another storm. No seats await, so the 7,000 guests remain standing, even though soldiers balancing on crutches. 13 of Roosevelt's grandchildren pose for a newsreel cameraman atop the stairs of the South Portico. Just a few steps from the podium, FDR's chief of staff, Harry Hopkins, stands ground level at the bottom of the stairs, fastidiously overseeing the proceedings. In addition to the veterans and dignitaries, a smattering of black faces can be seen in the crowd, reflecting Roosevelt's hope for a more racially integrated nation. The diverse attendees stand side by side in the elements, awaiting the noon start. Wartime shortages of gasoline and lumber mean that the traditional post-inaugural parade will not happen, and the swearing-in ceremony promises to be brisk. As the seconds tick down, the crowd presses closer and closer to the White House walls. Only a thin barrier of Secret Service agents and Washington police protect the curved outcropping known as the South Portico. At the stroke of 12, Reverend Angus Dunn steps to the lectern to begin the proceedings. The Right Reverend is Bishop of the Protestant Episcopal Diocese of Washington. Dunn is a pacifist, which makes him an odd selection to deliver an invocation in a time of all-out war. Even more intriguing, Dunn is visibly handicapped. He balances on crutches, having lost one leg to polio. His hands and remaining foot are deformed. Perhaps it can be said that the clergy is the only profession that would embrace a handicapped individual in this day and age. Yet the fact remains that Dunn has prospered. And unlike Franklin Roosevelt, who would never dare reveal his handicap, Angus Dunn does not hide who he is. Thus it's fitting that just 83 days hence, at a time when such fears will be completely meaningless to FDR, Angus Dunn will also lead prayers at the president's funeral service. Harry S. Truman, the 60-year-old senator from Missouri, steps to the lectern to be sworn in as vice president. This is a time of austerity in America and around the world. So Truman and Roosevelt have chosen to forego formal dress, preferring instead to wear dark business suits. The new vice president places his left hand on a family Bible and raises his right to take the oath of office. He is a small, wiry man with an infectious grin, a man unafraid to cry in public, but able to conceal his emotions when a situation turns competitive. Those unlucky enough to sit across a poker table from Harry Truman know this all too well. The S does not stand for anything. That single letter is an actual middle name. It was once Harry S. Truman's dream to attend West Point, but poor eyesight ended that ambition, making necessary the glasses he now wears. Truman, however, fought as an officer in the First World War. He aced the vision exam before his induction into the military by memorizing the eye chart. Truman made the leap from a small-time county commissioner to Missouri senator just 10 years ago. And at times, the power in Washington still overwhelms him. Now is such a moment. He and FDR barely know each other, and the president clearly has no interest in asking Truman's advice about how to run the country. It is also widely known that Truman did not campaign for his new job. In fact, he was initially reluctant to accept the vice president's spot on the ticket when it was offered at the Democratic convention last July. Foreseeing his own death, FDR had sought to replace his current vice president, Iowa native Henry Wallace, with someone less liberal and less inclined to ally himself too closely with the labor movement. Roosevelt studied the dossiers of several candidates before settling on the pragmatic Truman, but was left to a friend and longtime political aide to convince Harry Truman to take the job. "I think, Senator, that you're going to do it," Edward McKim told him one night during the Chicago convention. Truman got angry. "What makes you think I'm going to do it?" McKim knows Truman very well, has a deep knowledge of how to push his good friend's emotional buttons. Because there's a little 90-year-old mother down in Grandview, Missouri, that would like to see her son become president of the United States. Truman teared up at the image of his mother. He stormed out of the room and refused to speak with McKim. McKim was unfazed. He was well aware that fear played a part in Truman's reluctance, but there was enormous pressure in accepting the Chicago nomination. The consensus of opinion at the whole convention was that whoever was nominated for the vice presidency would eventually be president of the United States. And this does not mean waiting four more years until Roosevelt finally finishes his term. The president's ill health is now a very poorly kept secret. Even as he swears the oath of office, Truman is quite certain that FDR will soon die, and that he will become the 33rd president. That is a notion, in the words of another Truman confidant, that scares the very devil out of him. When the ballots were finally cast at the 1944 Democratic Convention, 1,176 delegates were asked to select the party's new vice presidential candidate. Senator Harry Truman garnered 90% of the vote. Incumbent Vice President Henry Wallace received just 9%. Now, 11 weeks after the Roosevelt-Truman ticket's landslide victory over Thomas Dewey's Republican ticket, the crowd in Washington bears witness as Truman recites the oath. It is an awkward moment, but the man swearing him in is none other than Henry Wallace, the ultra-liberal vice president he is now replacing. Soon, it is done. Harry Truman is the vice president of the United States. Now, Franklin Delano Roosevelt is helped to his feet and begins the shuffle of hips and swinging of leg braces that approximates his version of a walk. Supported by steel bands around his leg and hips that are concealed beneath his dark blue business suit, Roosevelt stands before the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Harlan Stone, his left hand resting on the same Dutch-language Bible as was used in his first three inaugurals. Per FDR's tradition, the Bible is open to 1 Corinthians 13, which teaches that of the three virtues, faith, hope, and love, the greatest trait mankind can display is love. FDR has 6 children and is devoted to his 13 grandchildren who now watch him just a few feet away. He also has a wife to whom he has remained married for 40 years. In his own way, FDR loves them all. But Franklin Roosevelt's biggest love is reserved for the American people, whom he has led through 12 daunting years of deprivation and war. Roosevelt was first elected president just 5 weeks before Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. But while Hitler has pursued a course of evil that is destroying his nation, Roosevelt has lifted America up from the lowest point in U.S. history to make it the most powerful nation on earth. He has done the people of America one final great favor by ensuring that his successor will not be an ideological extremist, but a man of the people who will do his best to heal the nation when the war inevitably ends. In this way, FDR does not repeat the mistake of Abraham Lincoln, who selected Andrew Johnson as his second vice president. Johnson's bumbling presidency deepened the rifts and divisions after the Civil War ended, and Lincoln was assassinated. As FDR well knows, some of the problems Johnson created still exist to this day. The crowd pressing in on the South Lawn does not know upon which Bible verse Roosevelt's hand rests, but they can hear his love in the timbre of his voice, so confident and assured, the father figure who will work tirelessly to lead the nation out of danger. When they draw him, political cartoonists like to accentuate FDR's strong, uplifted chin. This is how FDR actually appears as he recites the oath of office, a symbol of authority and optimism. And despite the heart disease that is slowly killing him and the bone-thin legs that can barely support him, the president hardly looks ill. His posture is ramrod straight, his complexion a healthy pink, and his voice strong and clear. The oath of office complete, FDR now turns to the crowd of 7,000 and to millions of Americans listening on the radio and prepares to deliver his final inaugural address. 4,000 miles away, General Patton is not paying attention to the inaugural. Patton, who thinks highly of Roosevelt, and whom the president finally addresses in person as old cavalryman and our greatest fighting general, a pure joy, is too busy directing the mop-up to be done on the battlefields of Luxembourg and Belgium and enduring military politics. Once again, Dwight Eisenhower is ignoring Patton. Having done the impossible, Patton is once again benched. Rather than having his top general lead the drive into Germany, Eisenhower is putting his strategic weight behind British Field Marshal Montgomery, who has demanded that he lead the decisive Allied push to the Rhine River. Montgomery cleverly planned for this next wave of combat by withholding most British troops from the Battle of the Bulge. While Patton's Third Army was taking casualties and losing scores of tanks and half-tracks, Montgomery was husbanding his resources. Now fresh and unscathed, the British Army and those American units under Montgomery's command are the new tip of the Allied spear. Meanwhile, as the inaugural takes place in Washington, Patton and Third Army are relegated to rooting out the last pockets of German resistance in a bulge. Knowing that being bitter and angry will not help his cause in the slightest, Patton tries to put a positive spin on the situation. "Saw a lot of dead Germans today frozen in funny attitudes," he writes to his wife. "I got some good pictures, but did not have my color camera, which was a pity. They are definitely on the run and suffered more than we hoped." Wild Bill Donovan is furious. He is in Chongqing, China, in the last week of a month-long around-the-world tour that began in Washington at the same time Bastogne was being liberated. As always, he is driven by personal, not ideological, motivations. It is his deep desire that his Office of Strategic Services, OSS, remain the world's most elite clandestine organization. As with the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin, Donovan has no moral or ethical qualms about dealing with the communists. He is positioning himself and the OSS for a prominent place in the post-war world. Nothing must stand in his way, and since it is clear to Donovan that communists will be a powerful global presence once Germany and Japan surrender, he is more than happy to deal with them. The Chinese communist rebels want $20 million to purchase arms for themselves to battle China's Japanese occupiers. Donovan is not concerned that this angers China's existing national government and its leader, Chiang Kai-shek, which rightly fears that the communists will someday attempt to take over the country. Nor is Donovan concerned that $20 million is far more money than the communists require for such a task. What concerns Donovan is that his secret slush fund, provided for him by Congress in its War Agencies Appropriations Act of 1944, is just $21 million in total. The terms of the money are that Donovan can spend it any way he likes, without regard to oversight. That money is meant to cover all his far-flung spy operations, from France to Germany to Greece, and even into the Vatican. Giving almost all his funds to the Chinese communists would be ridiculous. Donovan sends a counteroffer to the Chinese communist leader Mao Zedong, hoping he will lower his price. But today, the Chinese are not the source of Donovan's fury. His focus is on Europe. Donovan sees about the capture of OSS operatives near Patton's headquarters. The event happened in September and began with a flirtation at the bar at Paris's Ritz Hotel between American socialite Gertrude Sanford Legendre and a U.S. naval commander who doubled as one of Donovan's spies. The pair quickly struck up a romantic friendship, then borrowed a rented Peugeot and left for a joyride to the front. Gertrude, an undercover OSS agent, wanted to pay a visit to the headquarters of her friend, George Patton. Soon, they made the mistake of unwittingly crossing into Germany, where the Nazis promptly captured them. Legendre quickly became the subject of a massive propaganda blast by the Germans, portrayed as the first woman POW on the Western Front. The story was picked up by the global media. Legendre had the good sense to tell her captors that she was nothing more than a Red Cross employee. But Donovan knows it's just a matter of time before the Gestapo interrogators break her. Gertrude is privy to an enormous amount of top-secret information that could damage OSS clandestine operations. So while Donovan is concerned about their fates, he's equally outraged that his two spies allowed themselves to be captured in such ridiculous fashion. There will be no forgiveness if they return alive. While Bill Donovan is a man who believes in retribution and punishment, those who run afoul of his agenda will pay a heavy price. Patton, of course, had nothing to do with their capture, but Donovan is wary of the general due to Patton's notorious mistrust of the Russians. There's a growing sentiment in Washington that Patton's soaring popularity must be brought back down to earth. It was no secret in American G2 intelligence circles or the military press that certain politicians and generals did not want George Patton to garner more laurels. A war correspondent who traveled with Third Army will write after the war. So Donovan keeps an eye on Patton as he waits for news about his missing spies and secretly monitors the many situations around the globe that might somehow affect his post-war power. Meantime, as Donovan is set to fly from Chongqing to visit his British counterparts in Ceylon, the Chinese communists come back with their counteroffer. They want more money, not less. Donovan says he'll get back to them. The president's voice is strong and clear. We Americans of today, together with our allies, are passing through a period of supreme test. It is a test of our courage, of our resolve, of our wisdom, of our essential democracy, Roosevelt tells the nation. As he looks out on the crowd standing below him on the South Lawn, Roosevelt does not make eye contact with anyone in that sea of overcoats, scarves, and fedoras. Indeed, he does not make any attempt to recognize him at all. The president's gaze remains fixed on a line of trees in the far distance. His thoughts are focused on the microphone before him, knowing that its pitch-perfect vocal delivery left far more impact on the millions listening on radio. Our Constitution of 1787 was not a perfect instrument. It is not perfect yet. But it provided a firm base upon which all manner of men, of all races and colors and creeds, could build our solid structure of democracy. And so today, in this year of war, 1945, we have learned lessons at a fearful cost, and we shall profit by them. We have learned that we cannot live alone at peace, that our own well-being is dependent on the well-being of other nations far away. We have learned that we must live as men, not ostriches, nor as dogs in the manger. We can gain no lasting peace if we approach it with suspicion and mistrust or with fear. We gain it only if we proceed with the understanding that confidence and the courage which flow from conviction. After a few final sentences invoking the blessing of the Almighty, Franklin Roosevelt concludes his fourth inaugural address. It is just 558 words long. Only George Washington's second inaugural was shorter. 15 minutes after the ceremony began, it is over. The crowd files back out of the White House grounds without commotion or celebration. They have achieved their goal. They have seen history made. Harry Truman returns to his office in the Senate building and begins cleaning out his desk. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt turns his attention to an event even more pivotal than his inauguration. Next week's meeting with Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin to determine the fate of Nazi Germany. It will take place in a seaside Soviet resort town known as Yalta. Chapter 14, Auschwitz-Birkenau, Oświęcim, Poland, January 26, 1945, 1 a.m. The earth convulses as the Crema 5 explodes. Tongues of flame turn the coal-black winter sky a bright red. Nazi SS guards watch the inferno intently, but only for as long as it takes to know that the destruction is complete and there will be no need to place another round of dynamite charges. The grisly evidence is now destroyed. The guards march to the nearby barracks and order the prisoners out into the snow. The skeletal children with their prison tattoos and shaved heads respond immediately, knowing that the punishment for being too slow is a bullet. The prisoners get in line. The SS guards are normally fond of neat military-style rows, which allow them to take a head count. But on this night, they are in a hurry. The prisoners are ordered to march. Their destination is unclear, but the road soon takes them past the train station where they first entered this hellhole, and then on by the commandant's lavish house. They are leaving Birkenau, though they do not know why. Their way is lit by the burning remnants of the Crema 5, that horrible red brick building where hundreds of thousands of their fellow prisoners entered, but none walked out. Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, and the handicapped were led inside, locked in an airtight room, and then gassed when a cyanide-based pesticide, known as Zyklon B, was dropped through the ventilation system. Death came slowly as the prisoners, unable to breathe, tried to claw their way out of the room, leaving scratch marks on the walls. The bodies were then burned inside special ovens, with ashes going up the chimney flue, where they belched forth into the Polish sky and floated to the ground like snow, covering the nearby forests, ponds, and fields. The smell of death dominated the land. But Crema 5 is no more. The other four Auschwitz crematoria have also been detonated. Adolf Hitler has ordered that the murders be stopped and that all proof of his atrocities be destroyed. Though taking heavy losses, the Soviet army has blown through the German defense in Czechoslovakia and Hungary and is rapidly advancing west. To the north, the Russians have captured Warsaw and are racing through Poland with the intent of occupying Berlin before the Americans and their allies can get there. The Russians are so close to Auschwitz that the boom of their artillery can be heard in the distance, and the occasional barrel flash of a launching shell limns the horizon. The SS guards, who have been ordered to destroy the crematoria, are eager to move on, or they will soon become Russian prisoners, a certain death sentence for them. But even now, when their thoughts are filled with plans to escape, the SS cannot stop themselves from killing. It has become a way of life for them over the past years, as routine as eating breakfast. They have shot thousands by lining them up against the notorious Black Wall, as the firing squad barrier next to the medical experiments barracks is known. Now, as the SS men prod the prisoners through the snow, moving them to another section of the concentration camp on a road lined with electrified barbed wire fences, those child prisoners, unwilling or unable to walk the mile from the Birkenau section of the death camp to the main section of Auschwitz, are immediately shot dead. Those who bend down to quench their thirst by scooping snow into their mouths are shot dead. Many of the children now marching through the snow are twins who have been the subject of cruel experiments by a madman named Dr. Joseph Mengele. Those who stop to help their twins are also shot dead. 10-year-old Eva Moses and her twin sister Miriam stumble through the snow. As veterans of Mengele's experiments, their bodies are shattered. The angel of death, as he is known, showed them just one act of kindness, allowing them to keep their hair. The wind cuts through the thin prison uniforms the girls wear. Eva and Miriam's toes tingle and then go numb in their loose-fitting clogs. They have been in Auschwitz for a year. They were the only Jews in their hometown of Porz, Romania, and until 1944, no one seemed to pay much attention to them. But then the Nazis forced them to move out of their home and into a Jewish ghetto to await transport to Auschwitz. The memory of their arrival is still seared into Eva's brain. After a 70-hour ride from the Jewish ghetto, they stepped off the cattle cars. Guards yelled, "Schnell, schnell," quickly, quickly, as dog handlers allowed their snarling animals to lunge at the new arrivals. The twins' father, Alexander, and two older sisters, Edith and Elise, were immediately separated from the rest of the family. Jaffa, the girl's mother, sought to protect her young daughters. She grasped each one tightly by the hand, but a quick-thinking guard immediately noticed the twins. That's what they'd been trained to do, fine twins, and dwarves. With a gleam in his eye, that guard took the two girls to the special children's barracks reserved for the patients of Dr. Mangala. Eva and Miriam screamed at the top of their lungs, crying and pleading as Jaffa was torn from them, soon to be gassed and burned. They never saw their mother again. At age 10, the girls were completely on their own. Nevertheless, they were determined to live. The first time I went to use the latrine located at the end of the children's barracks, I was greeted by the scattered corpses of several children lying on the ground, Eva will later remember. It was there that I made a silent pledge, a vow, to make sure that Miriam and I did not end up on that filthy floor. Auschwitz-Birkenau was built on the top of a swamp, so conditions in the cramped barracks are always damp. A railway spur has run through the heart of the camp since the spring of 1944, delivering new prisoners several times each day. Once the cattle car stopped at the unloading ramp, prisoners were ordered to leave their belongings behind and to line up for processing. The elderly and women with children were designated for immediate extermination. Anyone under 14 was also sent directly to the gas chambers, which made Eva and Miriam very lucky to be alive. In all, 80% of those who survived the horrible journey from their homes to Auschwitz were sent straight to the gas chambers. Only those deemed capable of working as slave labor were allowed to live. There is no good job to have in a concentration camp. Some prisoners are chosen to serve as a capo, a leader of the other prisoners. Along with that come extra rations, but also the dirty work of collaborating with the Nazis by spying on fellow prisoners, effectively signing the death sentences of those who step out of line. The worst job of all goes to the prisoners who looked fit and strong enough to serve in the Sonderkommando. They will work the ovens, observing the SS officer as he gives the order to fill the gas chambers with Zyklon B, and then afterward carrying dead bodies from the gas chambers to the crematoria for burning. Each day they will grow weaker, thanks to the meager Auschwitz meal portions, and once they can no longer work, they themselves will be led into the gas chambers one final time. The entire Auschwitz complex is ringed by barbed wire and overseen by armed SS guards, standing in almost three dozen watchtowers. The Birkenau section backs up to a forest, and any inmate who can find a way through the wire to make a run for it is shot on sight. But this does not prevent escape attempts. Just a few months ago, in October 1944, 250 Sonderkommandos smuggled gunpowder into Kremlin 4 and blew it up. They then cut through the fence and escaped into the forest, but the SS quickly surrounded them. Though they lost three of their own in the attack, the SS killed all 250 Sonderkommandos, then hanged four women suspected of smuggling the gunpowder out of a munitions factory and giving it to the mutineers. Upon arrival at Auschwitz, those chosen to live are given a uniform that they will wear night and day, smocks for the women, pants and shirts for the men. Normal footwear is replaced by clogs made of wood or leather, but no socks, causing many prisoners to get blisters, which eventually lead to infection. In many cases, that leads to a slow and agonizing death from gangrene. Hundreds of barracks house the brutalized prisoners. There are skylights, but no windows. The floors are bare earth, and inmates sleep on wooden bunks stacked three tiers high. Rats are everywhere. The captives scratch constantly at the lice infesting their clothes and hair. The mattress is lice-infested straw, and blankets are often nothing more than rags. Food is precious and hoarded. Breakfast, just a cup of imitation coffee or tea. Lunch, thin soup. Dinner, a piece of black bread and a sliver of sausage. It is common practice to take a bite of the bread, then hide the rest in the lining of clothes until morning. When a prisoner dies in the night, the body is quickly searched for any hoarded bread. Since March, Eva and Miriam spent much of their time in the hospital barracks. They received injections that made their bodies swell and their temperatures soar with fever. They suffered through experimental surgeries and heard Mangala himself saying with laughter that they had just weeks to live. But even when death seemed imminent, Eva and Miriam knew they had to stay alive for each other. If I had died, Eva later explained, my twin sister Miriam would have been killed with an injection to the heart, and then Mangala would have done the comparative autopsies. The monstrous Mangala fled Auschwitz 9 days ago, moving west with his files of research to keep ahead of the Russians. Eva and Miriam Moses remain behind alive, but they are suffering from skin disease caused by lice bites, and their clothes are mere scraps of fabric. So now, with the Soviet army closing in on Auschwitz, they have no idea what will come next. The road on which the twins are marching leads directly to the Black Wall. The prisoners march through the gates into Auschwitz I, as the main compound is known, passing beneath a sign that mocks them with the words, "Work will set you free." That is a lie. Nothing will set them free but death or the liberation of the camps. Normally a small city of prisoners, Auschwitz is nearly empty. The Nazis are dependent on slave labor and have transported 60,000 Auschwitz prisoners off to other concentration camps to the west. Eva and Miriam stand in the heart of Auschwitz. Corpses are everywhere. Some have been shot, others simply starved to death. The bodies are contorted and unattended, frozen into the exact shape as when they breathe their last. The twins have been left behind because the SS guards believe they will not survive. With the Soviets so close, they have no time for any more killing. Instead, SS men pile into trucks and frantically race away from Auschwitz, leaving the prisoners either to starve to death or fall into the hands of the Russians. 1,000 prisoners mill about the camp or huddle inside the barracks. Among them is Dr. Adelaide Hartwell, a French psychologist who was convicted of disrupting what constitutes proper social etiquette to the Nazis. Jesuit priests are also convicted of this, as are communists, socialists, and more than 100,000 homosexuals who have died or will die in the death camps. Hartwell's crime was publicly protesting that Jews in the Nazi-occupied France were being treated unfairly. For this, she was sent to Auschwitz almost 2 years ago, where she has stayed alive by working in the hospital, treating those women suffering from the typhus that so often accompanies rat infestation. Eva, Miriam, and other prisoners call her the saint. But what the twins do not know is Dr. Hartwell refused to follow Mengele's direct orders that she perform grotesque surgeries on the twins. And so the prisoners wait. Are they really free? Or will some worse fate befall them? Because if they learned anything from their time in the death camps, it's just when things can't seem to get more horrific, they always do. Meanwhile, the SS guards have vanished into the night. A 55-year-old German Jew lies in his wooden bunk in the men's sick barracks at Auschwitz. It is 3 p.m. on January 27, 1945. Otto Frank's daughters are not as lucky as Eva and Miriam Moses, who will survive Auschwitz and go on with their lives. The Frank family moved to the Netherlands when the rise of Nazism increased anti-Jewish sentiment in Germany. On May 25, 1942, the London Telegraph ran a story with the headline, "Germans murder 700,000 Jews in Poland." The Times of London was soon reporting, "Over 1 million Jews dead since the war began," whereupon The Guardian noted that 7 million Jews were now in German custody and that Eastern Europe was a vast slaughterhouse of Jews. Still, neither Franklin Roosevelt nor Winston Churchill nor Joseph Stalin could effectively confront the atrocities. This was not a sinister plot, but rather an awareness that the Germans could not be stopped. The Jews could be saved only by the Allies winning the war. In a radio address to the American people on March 29, 1944, President Roosevelt made clear not only that he knew about Hitler's determination to kill every Jew in Europe, but also his own plans ultimately to punish all involved. Otto Frank's family went into hiding soon after those news reports emerged, moving into a secret apartment in Amsterdam. Life there was squalid and claustrophobic, but at least they were free. For 2 long years, the Franks evaded detection by the Nazis. They were less than a month away from Amsterdam's liberation by the Allies when the end came. On August 4, 1944, a secret informant whose name has never become known gave away the family's hiding place to the Gestapo. The Franks were arrested, and within a month, Otto, his wife Edith, and his teenage daughters arrived at Auschwitz. As soon as they disembarked from their cattle cars, families were disrupted. Otto Frank has not seen his wife and daughters since September. As he lies in his bunk this cold January day 5 months later, Frank does not know if his family members are alive or dead. He does not know that the women in his life, whom he loves so much, have suffered the indignity of being stripped naked within moments of their arrival at Auschwitz, their heads shaved for delousing, and then made to stand in line to have a number tattooed on their left forearms. That number, they were soon told, was their new identity. They no longer had names. During their time in Holland, young Annelies, just Anne to her family, kept a detailed journal of what their life in hiding was like. She was 5'4" tall, with an easy smile and dimples. Her eyes were gray, with just the slightest trace of green. Anne's wavy hair, before the German shaved her skull smooth, was brown and fell to her shoulders. Incredibly, both girls are still alive, as Otto Frank hears ecstatic shouts from outside his barracks. "We're free," the prisoners are shouting. "We're free." Soviet soldiers are marching into the camp, taking careful and cautious steps, suspicious of a surprise German attack. They wear winter-white camouflage uniforms and appear out of the snowy mist just like apparitions. Eva Moses cannot see them at first because they blend into the winter landscape so well. But just as she is not sure of what she sees, so the Soviet soldiers are not sure of what they have stumbled upon. Corpses everywhere, living skeletons, and the hollow faces of those who are being liberated, but who are so close to death it does not matter. When I saw the people, it was skin and bones. They had no shoes, and it was freezing. They couldn't even turn their heads. They stood like dead people, the first Russian officer into the camp will later remember. I told them, the Russian army liberates you. They couldn't understand. Some few who could touched our arms and said, "Is it true? Is it real?" The Soviet soldiers move from barracks to barracks, shocked at what they see. When I opened the barrack, I saw blood, dead people, and in between them, women still alive and naked. Russian officer Anatoly Shapiro will later remember. It stank. You couldn't stay a second. No one took the dead to the grave. It was unbelievable. The soldiers from my battalion asked me, "Let us go. We can't stay. This is unbelievable." Despite their brutal reputations, the Soviet soldiers are kind to the prisoners, who stare back at them with gratitude in their eyes. But the Russians have seen so much in this time of war that many are numb to the horrors before them. I had seen towns being destroyed. I had seen the destruction of villages. I had seen the suffering of our own people. I had seen small children maimed. There was not one village that had not experienced this horror, this tragedy, these sufferings, one Soviet soldier will note wearily. And yet the Soviets see that Auschwitz is different. "We ran up to them," Eva Moses and her sister Miriam will later recall. "They gave us hugs, cookies, and chocolates. Being so alone, a hug meant more than anybody could imagine, because that replaced the human worth we were starving for. We were not only starved for worth, we were starved for human kindness. And the Soviet army did provide some of that." Eva Moses has kept the promise that she made to herself. Neither her corpse nor that of her sister will ever litter the filthy floor of a barracks lavatory. As Otto Frank rises from his sickbed to celebrate his newfound freedom, his thoughts immediately turn to finding his family. But he will never find them. Instead, in the weeks and months and years to come, he will discover threads of their travels, which will allow him to piece together the horrible ways in which they died. Otto Frank's beloved wife, Edith, died of starvation right here at Auschwitz. His daughters were transferred to Bergen-Belsen in northern Germany. Margot Frank died soon afterward. Her sister, Anne, had just 5 weeks to live. She would die bald and covered with insect bites, her emaciated body finally done in by a typhoid outbreak that would kill 17,000 inmates at Bergen-Belsen. She was just 15 years old. Judaism, Adolf Hitler tells the German people on the 12th anniversary of the day he became chancellor, began systematically to undermine our nation from within. Hitler's physical health has further deteriorated. His hands shake, his eyes water. He is now taking twice-a-day injections of methamphetamine so he can even function. And yet he and Eva Braun carry on the charade that the war can still be won. But Hitler's location inside the bombed-out ruins of Berlin tells the true story. It has been 2 weeks since his personal train slunk into the once-proud capital of Germany in the dead of night. The curtains were drawn as a precaution against Allied bombing, though that is really more than a habit than anything else. The Luftwaffe has been destroyed. American and British bombers are now free to attack Berlin in broad daylight, which they do most days by 9 in the morning as the city's embattled residents hurry off to work. There will be no stopping the Allies on the Western Front. Of that, Hitler is certain. To the east, where the Russian superiority is 11 soldiers for every Wehrmacht fighter, the situation is even worse. On this very day, January 30th, 1945, Hitler's Minister of Armaments, Albert Speer, has sent Hitler a memo informing the Führer that the war is lost. Germany does not have the industrial capacity to churn out the tanks, planes, submarines, and bombs necessary to defeat the Allies, nor does it have the manpower. Nevertheless, Hitler has no plans to surrender. Nazi scientists are currently working on a new type of weapon, known as an atomic bomb. Once it is capable of being detonated, he can use it to wipe the Allied armies off the map. On this day, I do not want to leave any doubt about something else. Against an entire hostile world, I once chose my road according to my inner call and strode it as an unknown and nameless man to find success. Often they reported I was dead, and always they wished I were. But in the end, I remained a victor in spite of all. My life today is with an equal exclusiveness determined by the duties incumbent on me. Hitler now makes his home in central Berlin on the Wilhelmstrasse. He lives underground in an elaborate bunker. The blonde-haired, blue-eyed Eva Braun still tends to him, though she often spends time outside the bunker and does not sleep there most nights. She remains calm, believing that Hitler's cruel genius can once again win the day. Living in an underground bunker is just one more precaution that is necessary in a time of war. Adding to the air of normalcy is that Hitler's beloved German Shepherd Blondie and her new puppies make their home in the bunker as well. Even though he fears that a direct hit from an Allied bomb will kill him, Adolf Hitler ultimately believes he will be saved. However grave the crisis may be at the moment, it will, despite everything, finally be mastered by our unalterable will, by our readiness for sacrifice, by our abilities. We shall overcome this calamity too, and this fight will not be won by Central Asia, but by Europe. And at its head will be the nation that has represented Europe against the East for 1,500 years and shall represent it for all times, our greater German Reich, the German nation. Adolf Hitler has 90 days to live. He will never leave Berlin again. Chapter 15, A Rural Road in Poland, Spring, 1945, Night. Helena Citronova is on a mission. She is a 25-year-old Slovakian Jew who survived Auschwitz thanks to her beauty, elegant singing voice, and guile. Helena was among the first women deported from Slovakia on March 25, 1942. The women in the group were all between 18 and 22 years old and chosen for their youth. Their train chugged out of Poprad station at 8 o'clock on that fateful spring evening, climbing slowly over the volcanic Verlot Mountains in the night to arrive in Auschwitz the following morning. Now Helena and her older sister, Razinka, bed down in a barn, hoping for rest after a long day on the road. They are hungry and thirsty, but for now there is a roof over their heads and they are warm, yet there is no safety in a war zone. The Soviet liberation of Auschwitz has come at a time when the Red Army's immediate focus is on capturing Berlin. Its soldiers have little interest in providing care for the thousands of women and children the Nazis have left to die. Helena and Rozinka are walking hundreds of miles to their home in the central Slovakian town of Hunami. Like so many others, they are marching away from the Germans as the Soviets are racing toward them. Each night, the barns and hedgerows of Germany and southern Poland are filled with refugees hoping for a few hours' sleep before they rise again to continue their journeys. Many have vague hopes of temporarily resettling in a major city, such as Budapest. Not Helena and Razinka Citronova, though. They have endured Auschwitz and deportment to another camp just a week before the Russians liberated Birkenau. Throughout their long captivity, they have imagined the day they will once again walk through the front door and into the warmth and comfort of the house in Homine, where they were raised. Now, as they try to sleep in the hay, the two women hear the soft breathing of their exhausted fellow travelers. Sleeping so close to strangers does not bother the sisters. They slept four to a cramped bunk while in Auschwitz. Sharing a stable feels far less claustrophobic. Razinka is the plainer of the two women. She is 10 years older than Helena, but it is the loss of her two children in the gas chambers that has aged her. However, if not for Helena, she would not be alive at all. Within Auschwitz-Birkenau, there was a building where the clothing, suitcases, and other personal belongings of prisoners were taken after they'd been stripped upon arrival at the train platform. It was known as Canada. Laborers were allowed to steal clothing or food clandestinely as they searched through the piles of belongings for the gold, cash, and other valuables that would be sent back to Berlin to fund the Nazi war machine. Helena was not originally assigned to Canada, but she quickly grasped the reality that her life would be easier if she could secure a spot in the sorting house. When a woman she knew who worked in Canada died, Helena switched uniforms with her and took her place the next day. She was instantly found out. The capo, as the Jewish informants who supervised their fellow prisoners were known, made it clear that she would be punished. This was no idle threat. The capos could be incredibly harsh to their fellow Jews. In one instance, an Auschwitz capo beat an inmate over the head with a shovel. Then, as the man fell to the ground, the capo shoved the blade down into his throat, breaking his neck. He then pried the dead man's mouth open and hammered out his gold teeth. So Helena had good reason to be scared that some sort of severe punishment awaited her. Then, before the capo could betray her, fate intervened. The date was March 21, 1944. Helena had been a prisoner in Auschwitz for 2 years. That day was also, coincidentally, the birthday of an SS guard named Franz Wunsch. Known to be an avowed Jew hater, the 22-year-old Wunsch was in charge of the Canada work detail. That day, he took the liberty of stopping the sorting process for a short time and asked if anyone would sing for him. Recognizing the opportunity for what it was, Helena volunteered. Her voice soon wafted through the sorting house, a stunning contrast to the sadness of ransacking dead people's clothing. Wunsch was transfixed. He immediately fell for the raven-haired Helena. Not long after, he took the bold risk of handing her a love note. Relations between guards and Jews were strictly forbidden, although they were a common occurrence. The guards took the risk for the sex. The prisoners took the gamble to save their lives. But Helena was not interested, not at first. "He threw me a note," she would later remember. "I destroyed it right there and then. But I could see the word love. I fell in love with you." Helena was appalled. "I thought I'd rather be dead than involved with an SS man. For a long time afterward, there was just hatred. I couldn't even look at him." But the smitten Wunsch was persistent. Every day he would seek her out among the women who worked at Canada. He would sneak her cookies and took special interest in her welfare. The SS guard was trying to buy his way into her heart. Then an incredible thing happened. Helena's sister, Razinka, along with the two children, arrived at Auschwitz via a train from Slovakia. Wunsch noticed them. "Tell me quickly what your sister's name is before I'm too late," he demanded of Helena. "You won't be able to," she replied coolly. "She has two young children." Wunsch was taken aback. "Children can't live here." Finally, Helena gave him her sister's name. Wunsch then raced to the crematorium and for show beat Razinka in front of her children, explaining to his fellow SS guards that she had disobeyed an order to work in Canada. The guards looked the other way as Wunsch dragged her off, leaving Razinka's young daughter and infant son to die. Harsh as it was, Wunsch saved the woman's life. Helena, however, now owed a debt to the SS guard. "In the end, I loved him," Helena will later recall of the affair that began that day, but it could not be. Franz Wunsch was sent to the Russian front as the war came to an end, along with many of his fellow guards. His last act of kindness was making sure that Helena and Razinka each had a pair of warm fur-lined boots to help them survive the winter. When the soldiers of the Soviet 60th Army entered the camp on January 27, they were particularly taken with the plunder inside the building known as Canada. Almost a million articles of women's clothing and half as many men's garments still awaited to be sorted. But that job no longer fell to Helena and Radzinka. Their nightmare was over, at least for the moment. Working in Canada meant they had enjoyed better rations and regular access to water. They had not been beaten and were extremely healthy compared to so many others in the camp. So they began walking home to Slovakia, eager to put as much distance between themselves and Auschwitz as possible. But isolated country roads are never completely safe, even in peacetime. Now, as Helena and Razinka sleep in the barn, their nightmares begin again. Soviet soldiers, reeking of alcohol, suddenly invade their small sanctuary. It is not one Red Army soldier, or even two, but an entire gang. They are thin from their long days of marching. Their clothes are threadbare. One by one, the women sleeping in the barn are wrestled to the ground, and if they try to run, are brutally raped, sometimes twice. They were drunk, totally drunk, Helena later remembers. They were wild animals. As this goes on, Helena disguises her looks, messing her hair and covering her face in grime to make herself appear unattractive. The plain and matronly Rosinka helps shield her sister from the soldiers by pretending to be her mother. Some of those attacks show the Russian soldiers their camp tattoos and cry out that they are Jewish, hoping it will make the Russians see them as undesirable. The soldiers reply, delivered in terse